Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, the 20th of 1998. In the Creekside Room this afternoon, we have Louise Williams. Today's session number is 98.7, and it's titled Images of Service, Keeping the Door. Let's listen in.
Thank you for coming. Welcome to you. What I'm doing in these sessions is taking some of the traditional roles that deacons and deaconesses had in the early church and using those as kind of images for us to talk about the kind of Christian service that all of us are called to by virtue of our baptism. And I put some words on the board that I will use, and they're not words that are necessarily common in everyone's vocabulary. Diakonia, which is the Greek word that's translated in the New Testament as ministry or service. There are some chairs here in the front if you'd like to come. It's the word that's translated in most of our English language New Testaments as ministry or service. And it, of course, is the word from which all of these others are derived, diaconal, or sometimes it's called diaconal. It's, you'll hear it pronounced both ways, just as an adjective referring to service-oriented. Diaconate is that group of people made up of deacons and deaconesses, or diaconal ministers, people who are set apart generally in some way for the public ministry of service in the church. And then, of course, deacon and deaconesses. And today's topic is doorkeeper, or go-between. And we've previously done washing feet, waiting tables, and storytelling. And tomorrow's will be keeping the light or tending the light. So what I'd like you to do is sort of let your imaginations go a little bit with that doorkeeping image, and I will give you a little bit of background and hope that it will trigger some thoughts in your own minds as to how it is that you are involved in that kind of doorkeeping ministry or service, and how others that you know are, and how it is that the church can be doing that. First of all, in the early church, when the church was under persecution, it was the deaconesses and deacons who stood at the door when the community gathered, usually in secret, and they checked the credentials of the people who presented themselves to come in. So they wanted to make sure that there were not spies coming in that were going to check off the list and persecute them. They welcomed the worshipers. They arranged for hospitable and orderly space for the community to gather. We might say that they were the first greeters and ushers in the church. There, in many of Paul's letters, he makes reference to specific people. Probably people who were carrying his letters, and they would then present that to the congregation or to the deacon or deaconess who was at the door to let them in. And one that people in the diaconate like to quote is Romans 16, where Paul says, "I commend to you our sister Phoebe," and it's often translated a deaconess in the church at Cenchrea. "Receive her as befits the saints, because she's been a helper of many and of myself as well." Some people think that Phoebe was the person who carried the letter from Paul to the church at Rome. And when she got there, she presented her credentials. Come in, there's some seats in the front if you'd like. Look, in the early church, liturgically, the members of the diaconate announced the movement of the liturgy, or the worship. You might say they acted sort of as MCs in the worship. They were often the people who went down into the congregation, for example, to receive the offering and to bring it to the Eucharistic table. They were the people who invited others to exchange the kiss of peace, and this was very much connected with the role that the diaconate had in the community of giving attention to the quarrels and lawsuits within the community, to be working for reconciliation between people. They were the ones who dismissed the congregation after the benediction at the end of the liturgy. For those of us who might be used to the role of assisting minister in the Lutheran Book of Worship, that is pretty much the deacon's role. They assisted at and sometimes performed baptism, which was the rite of initiation in the community. So you can see again, they were on the boundaries. We talked yesterday about how they were the people who were involved in the education of those people coming into the community and sort of helping the new newly baptized adults to be assimilated into the Christian life. They carried the concerns of the world into the congregation by bidding the prayers of the church. So you can see that there was always this movement kind of back and forth, bringing the world into the church and taking the church back out into the world. They kind of stood at the boundaries between the insiders and the outsiders. They were positioned at the edges, and they moved across those boundaries as go-betweens or agents or emissaries. The way the early church was organized in about the 3rd and 4th century, very often the deacons and deaconesses were emissaries of the bishop who oversaw the large congregations, and they were the people who went out to tend to those people who weren't present when the church gathered for worship, those who were ill, who were staying away, the delinquent members, we would call them today, the shut-ins, the bereaved, the widows and orphans. So they were the emissaries of the bishop to the whole community. They were kind of the go-betweens from church to world, as I said, and from God to the rest of creation. They carried messages, they ran errands, they acted on behalf of the one who sent them. They were responsive, mobile, accessible, leading the church more and more into service in the world, and inviting the world with its longings and pains evermore into the church. Certainly Jesus shows us the way. Jesus, who was very much on the boundary between earth and heaven, between God and humanity. Jesus, who moved among the people so that they could touch him, cry out to him, reach out to him. And Jesus, who ushered in the reign of God into the fallen creation. And Jesus, who winsomely welcomed all kinds of people into the circle of God's love. We might say that this kind of diaconia, this kind of service, involved ministries of outreach, going out into the world and finding the people that the church didn't ordinarily touch. It was a ministry of hospitality, of welcoming the stranger. And I'm going to digress just a little bit and talk about hospitality, because I really think that doorkeeping is really a hospitality kind of role. To be hospitable really is to make an open space so that the other person can come in. It doesn't demand that the other person become as we are, but gives them room in our space to be who they are. It means welcoming the other person while that other person is a stranger. few years ago, Parker Palmer wrote a book called The Company of Strangers. Some of you maybe know that book, have read it. And he describes how our society really has come to fear strangers, and so we protect ourselves from encounters with them. He talks about how we even sometimes pretend that strangers don't exist. For example, by quickly coming to a first name basis. You know, that people that we don't know, we call by their first name, as if they were not strangers to us. But the stranger can only really know hospitality in its fullest when that person is loved, is taken in as a stranger, as somebody who is on the outside. To practice hospitality then means always to put ourselves more and more where strangers can be found. And you might think about who are the strangers in our world today.
I guess I'm a little confused.
Okay.
You say take strangers in, but a way to avoid doing that is call them by their first name. And yet, I guess I see that as part of taking them in.
Well, I think it can be. I think what Parker Palmer was saying is that, that for example, in our churches, when a new person comes and a person doesn't really know other people, that when we get very quickly on a first name basis, when we call that person by a first name, we suggest that we know that person, that person is already one of us. And I think what he's saying is that hospitality isn't pretending that person is not a stranger, but really accepting that person as a stranger into our midst. Is that?
I've got to process. I got to work it.
Okay, all right. Somebody else, does it make sense to you? Maybe someone else who's read Company of Strangers who knows Parker Palmer's. But he talks about how you go to the doctor's office and that everybody calls you by your first name, whether they know you or not. And
call your doctor by his or her first name. I do.
The only thing is they can't pronounce your first name correctly.
Yeah. Well, in my case, I go by my middle name, so then when they call me by my first name, I don't know who they're talking about.
It's a dead giveaway.
That's right.
I think the worst is when you go to a place like Walmart and after they look at your credit card or your check, they call you by your first name. Mm-hmm. It really bothers me a lot. Oh. Maybe that's the opposite of that. The feeling that it's their attempt to try and make you feel warm and embraced by calling you by your first name. Mm-hmm. I want to say to them, you don't know who I am. Please do not refer to me by my first name. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that really is the dynamic that he's talking
about. Do you actually
about.
Tell them that? Don't call me by my first name.
No.
I think that's part of their training.
Yeah, it is part of their training.
Actually, what I have done is thank them when they didn't call me by my first name. Oh, yeah, I said, I appreciate you calling me Mrs. Friesen-Carver instead of Michelle. And I just leave it at that. But I said that a number of times. So.
Yeah, I think businesses go to great pain to train their employees to do that very thing.
Fine line between marketing and hospitality, probably.
Right. Well, is that hospitality? What's that?
Well, I think it's not a fine line. I think it's a huge line.
It's kind of interesting because we just have been taking a very, very elementary Spanish class. And part of the conjugation of pronouns is one of them is tú, meaning mm-hmm. you. And then usted is you also. Mm-hmm. But tú is very informal, and usted is used formally, which probably all of you know, but I just learned. And our instructor was a waitress one time, and she said this guy kind of struck up a Spanish conversation with her and called her tú. Mm-hmm. She says, I was very offended at that because he did not know me, and he had no business saying tú. So there is a... a period there where you need to respect somebody before you get too intimate with them, probably.
Yeah, and in English, we don't have those kind of differentials as some other languages.
However, we used to, and the Quakers chose to use the familiar form with one another, which is why they said "be" with one another. It was their sign that they were not practicing status, but had all agreed to be at the most familiar status with one another.
Did you say something?
My mom used to work in real estate. She's 87, and so you know what era she comes from. And when they would call her by her first name, people would, you know, she would be dealing business with and taking them in her car to look at properties and so on, and they call her by her first name. She says, oh, she just never get used to that. She would never call any of her clients by their first name.
My first position as a deaconess was in a parish in Western Canada, in Edmonton. And the people really were much more formal than what I was used to, and I was not called by my first name by parishioners.
And I come from Canada, too, and when I first came down to the States, people in the grocers, in the stores, would say honey or sweetie or something like that. It's just turned me over.
But I think the point that he's making is that by doing that, we are acting as if that we're not strangers to each other. We're pretending that somehow we... that dynamic is not there.
But as an expression of developing intimacy, does he still say that it's not appropriate?
No, I think he would say as you develop a relationship, as what he says is you move from the public sphere to the private sphere, then it becomes appropriate.
Hey, you were commenting earlier, just a thought, about the person at the door, which had credentials. We just came back from Venezuela, and we worshipped at a little Lutheran mission over in Puerto La Cruz, well, Lecheria. And it is very close to a very low-income area, and they have someone at the door to
check everybody.
Mm-hmm. It's a locked door, and you have to be identified before you can.
Who are they?
Lutheran.
I mean, who are they? Who do they not want to come in?
I don't know. Uh-huh. Just there a few times, uh-huh. But I think it is people who would rob and steal, perhaps abuse. The pastor shared with us that some of the families who belong to the church. Not everyone can come to church at the same time. Someone has to stay home and guard the house. Mm-hmm. So it's a difficult lifestyle. Mm-hmm.
So that it's a little bit different from what was happening.
A little bit different, but still physical safety is a portion of it.
Well, maybe that's enough about hospitality. We can talk more about that later. That there are all kinds of levels of hospitality in terms of inviting people into our home, into our attitudes, into our language, so that we can be more inclusive. So ministries of outreach, ministries of hospitality, ministries of interpretation, so that other people can understand the language that is being used, and ministries of reconciliation, which is what John's been talking about all weekend. welcoming bringing parties together, making the word come alive in languages that people can understand, helping estranged peoples come together, that this really is the aspect of ministry in this doorkeeping, go-between kind of thing. I'd like to just give you a few examples, and then maybe we can have some conversation about where you see the church doing this, where you see people that you know doing this. A person who comes to my mind is a deaconess that I know in New Hope, Minnesota, where she's coordinator of the congregation's ministries of outreach and new member assimilation, almost a direct line from this kind of thing. A deacon, Tom Doris, who was killed in Switzerland a few years ago, was a journalist, and he spent most of his time, you know Tom, new Tom, spent most of his time working within the church press, really interpreting the church's ministry, and particularly the diaconate to the church. But he really saw his whole vocation, his whole calling to do that kind of interpretation. I think of people who sign for people who have hearing disabilities. I visited Porto Alegre, Brazil, and visited a home that diaconal ministers operated there for unwed mothers. And most of these mothers were virtually children themselves. And because when they became pregnant, they were kicked out of their families, they were kicked out of school, they basically would have had all doors closed to them for any kind of successful life, except for these diaconal workers who opened doors for them, brought them in, taught them parenting skills, job skills, gave them a place where they were valued, so that they could go back out to be good parents and work in gainful employment. I think of congregations around the country that are reconciled in Christ congregations that have made it known that they are congregations that have their doors open to gay and lesbian people. And probably we ought to be next door to talk a little bit about that, that doorkeeping, that reaching out. I think about all kinds of people who put themselves in awkward and even sometimes dangerous positions to reach out, to interpret, to offer hospitable places. And we were talking in one of the earlier sessions about that, putting ourselves at risk in order to welcome people who might, have the potential of being dangerous to us. All of these people who are on the boundaries between the church and the world. So where are some of the places that you see that happening? Yeah.
I could add another one to the list.
Okay.
Deaconess I know at campus ministry, who is definitely between the world of the university students and the church. And one way she's found to do it, she's a person of a million inventive ideas. But one thing that they have done for a number of years now is for the seasons of the church here, they prepare a gift of some kind, a little basket that might have Easter eggs or might have cards for one per week for Advent or something that interprets the church year, but also is really appealing to the university students. They'll leave them on the doorknobs of the people on their mailing list, so they get something from the campus ministry. And they also do this by email. So in 4 years of the students going through this, they may never or maybe once show up at the campus ministry center, but the deaconess is keeping in touch with them by email and by these little tangible gifts as the time goes on, and the feedback that they get, the students have felt included and they've been instructed and nourished in faith in a way that really appeals to them.
So, and maybe we can move that. I appreciate that commercial for that. And if you have some of you know other examples, that's fine. But I really want us to try to talk more about now how you, as the people of God, are involved in that kind of doorkeeping and go between service. Who are some of the other people that you know who are doing that? Yes.
Even these student ministers.
Well, no, I was thinking about back in Washington.
Oh, yeah.
Retired. You tell them about that. You do good at that.
Go ahead. Right.
Go ahead. We were stationed in Washington for 3 years, and we were members of the worshiping community. First Trinity, just off Judiciary Square there, remarkable church. But they had a very active ministry to retarded adults, mentally handicapped adults, some severely and some not so severely. But there were probably 60 or so in the group that they served, and on a Sunday morning, perhaps a dozen to 15 would show up. But it was a them and an us. And it was a good ministry, and there was a lot of good stuff happening there, but it was not integrated with the church. And we began sitting with them and working with them and integrating. Mm-hmm. And now we're here that it is integrated.
Isn't that wonderful? Just because you moved.
I think they were just afraid to move and do it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They take part in the Christmas program. It's a downtown church, so there's very few children in the Sunday school, perhaps 15 or 20 at most. But these retarded folks are the shepherds, and one of them fell asleep in front of the altar one Christmas, and that was fine.
They're accepting of them now, which is great.
Sounds a little bit like the story that you told on Monday, I think it was, John.
How about the role of the parish nurses now?
Okay.
So many are volunteers.
Mm-hmm. Going out to those people who have need of physical care as well as spiritual care. Mm-hmm.
I was at a workshop on worship recently where the presenter got very enthusiastic with examples, and this is a wonderful idea, of people who are involved in some of the assisting minister positions in church, whether they're ushers or greeters or assisting ministers at the table, growing out of those interests to do some service in the world so that the people who serve the bread and wine at communion are also the nucleus of the Social Concerns Committee efforts towards world hunger. Mm-hmm. Or the ushers have become active in literacy because you can't have someone read a bulletin unless they can read. Mm-hmm. And so the presenter was making those kind of links between what the people were doing as volunteers in church and what they were doing as go-betweens outside the church.
And that really was the dynamic that was there for the deacons and deaconesses in the early church, that their liturgical roles were expressions of what they were doing in the community and kind of symbolized that. And that's really a neat thing to try to make those links then going the other way.
Well, Louise knows this because we go to the same church, but I think our outreach program in our church with building houses has been, we haven't been engaged with Habitat for Humanity, but got started on our first church was seeing the need of a family who had moved from Chicago, I think from Chicago, sort of before we came, who it was a mother with a number of children who really needed a home, and the land was provided, and the church entirely built this house, and we've now done three houses for people in the community. One was a person, a member of our church, who was paraplegic and was living in a rundown trailer house that was just dilapidated. And I think her parents actually somehow provided the land, and we provided all the labor for building this house, and we helped on that one a little bit. But that's good. a neat program for us.
Yeah, a neat kind of outreach.
There are two things that we have at my church now that are fairly recent. One of them is that at the end of the communion service, before the dismissal and all, maybe this is a part of, is common in a lot of other, your churches, I don't know, but we have the elder who is assisting will take the bread and wine and carry it out of the sanctuary, and it is then designated, or it's symbolic of going out and taking communion to the shut-ins. And I was an elder at church for 3 years, and back then, you know, we would just, after the service, we would pick up our little kits and fill them, and out we would go. This is much more visible to the whole congregation, that there are fellow members out there who need to be in communion with us as well. So that's something that I really like, and I'm glad we do that. The second one, and I haven't been involved in it, but we now, somehow we get names of new people into the community, and we worked out a deal with a bakery in the town that, I don't know how often, but people deliver bread to these, to newcomers with, I don't know, Louise, what's if there's information about the church in it and so on, but we actually get that bread donated by this bakery, so, and it's good bread.
Yes.
We had two deacons in our church for a while, deaconesses, and one Sunday morning, one of them said, there's a lady here that needs to have some help. She has a small baby and her husband and a little kid that's about 3 years old, and they just arrived in the city, and they had a truck, a rental, and they had to turn their truck in, and this thing was still full of their stuff. And so a bunch of us got in our cars and went over to this house, and we spent like 4 hours unloading boxes of stuff into this house. I don't know how she ever straightened it out afterwards. It must have been a zoo for weeks. But they came to church a couple of times, but I think we kind of overwhelmed them by being so attentive. You know, some people don't like that, and I think they were those folks. But she sat in the kitchen with her little tiny baby, and she just could hardly move, you know, and it was just really fun to do that. The other thing we did, that same deaconess did, was she started a clothes closet, and we give away free clothes, and the average, it's for 2 hours on Wednesday morning, and we average about 70 people that come in. It's a downtown church in Tacoma. But they come and they go out of there. We know they take the stuff off and sell it at garage sale, but you know, you gotta eat too. And sometimes they'll come in, like the grandmas will come, and they'll get a whole lot of kids' clothes. And then they'll come back the next week with all the ones that didn't fit. It's really amazing how much it helps. Some people come, and there's a mental health ministry going on downstairs. Unfortunately, the clothes closet is upstairs, and it's very difficult. But downstairs, we have this great big room, and there's a mental health person there, and they have coffee and donuts. And so those people, it's absolutely the worst possible thing for them to be eating is coffee and donuts. We got to have a talk about that. But they come in and they sit around these round tables and talk to each other and to this wonderful person who's doing this. And it just, right at the time of the clothes closet. So the mental health people are getting help at that moment. And it's just, things can work like synergistically like that. If you're on the edge, and boy, those are on the edge, all that stuff is. And the other thing that we have in our church is that we turn over the whole building to a group called Bridges. And we have a huge facility. The Wells Hall is a big wooden floor
over the top of a full-size gymnasium. The thing was built in like 1920-something. Mm-hmm. And then we have another big church with the whole schmear just down the walkway. And there's lots of classrooms and everything. But Bridges is a place for grieving children. And there's lots of adults, all the parents that are left, or the aunts, or the grandparents, whoever's taking care of these kids. And then they have the people from the social services workers that are paid to deal with them. And they draw pictures, and they're on all the walls in the Sunday school rooms and everything, all this stuff from Bridges. It's just, you can see the good things that they do. They have a Christmas tree, and they put their a story to their loved one on the Christmas tree, and you know, you read that and you cry, and you don't even know these people, but it's wonderful. Well, I do know some of them, of course. We just don't say come to church, we just say come here and use this huge facility. And it's really...
It sounds like you know about a practice hospitality.
Yeah. Well, the members of the congregation are not all real active in that. We did get about four of us together and paint Tacoma Beautiful. That one together. Scraped one weekend and painted the map, so it's really fun. Pretty little house. It's all painted up with trim and everything. The gal that lives there, she talks perfectly fine. I think she just flat broke and probably inherited the house and can't afford to do anything. So, but it was fun for us to play ball.
I think a really simple thing that has to do with hospitality and interpretation is a failed worship service. I think some of us may do a good job of making people feel welcome and understand what's going on. And there may be some of us that are jumping from the LBW to the With One Voice to some insert to some, you know, thing that everybody else has memorized, but the poor person who's walking in the door has no idea what's going on. And I think that you know, that really takes a lot of coordination and thoughtfulness and planning to make that worship service so that it's worshipful for the stranger who comes. And that is a really important hospitality that we often ignore.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it's helpful just to walk into your own congregation, your own church building, as if you were a stranger. Would you know where to go when you come in the door? Would you know where you're supposed to get your hymnal or what you're supposed to do?
And you know, our old logo thing that has the welcome place, you know, that.
I guess I'm reacting a little bit to your comment that it takes organization. I think what it takes is the heart of the people there. We were at a church in New York City, and a guy came in and was obviously not familiar with the liturgy, so we sat with him and went through the stuff, but that wasn't organized.
No, I agree. Yeah. But we also could be doing it in a way that you know, that if somebody happens to not sit by somebody who's getting hospitalized, that they're going to be okay too.
Just to be
a little bit of both would be helpful.
Just to be alerted to it.
Are there some more risky places where there's a boundary that needs to be bridged?
Maybe the subject next door.
Okay.
We've had that riskiness. We're from Iowa, and so we've been one of our neighboring congregations. There's been a big issue on the pastor who's openly gay. And it's a very difficult issue, and one that people are afraid to discuss and talk about. And,
the requests for same-sex marriages.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
At our church, years ago, I haven't done it recently, but there would be a little announcement in the bulletin saying that there may be, or there probably would be somebody there who had AIDS. And therefore, if you had a cold or any kind of infection, please be sure to use in teaching, because that could be devastating to one of your brothers and sisters in Christ.
Yeah. Not telling them to do it, it's telling us to do it, so that they will not get sick from us. That's wonderful.
And then members of the congregation spearheaded the building, or rebuilding of a house with help from the congregation. That was in AIDS hospitals.
Yeah, we have any food left over from anything, we just run around the corner of Rusty Alley and give it to them, and they love it because they really have a hard time keeping their weight up. And we have a lot of people who don't have that problem. We don't need to take home all that potato salad or whatever it is. It's really fun.
In the church we were affiliated with for a while in New York City, St. Luke's, just off Times Square, has a theater district, and there's a lot of problems with the things there. But it's really neat. It's such a warm, welcoming congregation that many of the folks who are dying of AIDS will come to that congregation. Mm-hmm. And Dale shared with us one year he had 17 funerals there. He said, come back. We have made some very dear friends of a Spanish family there where their son had AIDS and died.
20 years old.
And still correspond with them. The Rosados.
I think some of our missionaries have some extremely difficult situations where they have to try to blend Christianity with all these cultures.
Mm-hmm. Oh boy, that is hard. That would be another example of trying to bridge some boundaries. And
at least we try to do it now.
Uh-huh. Right.
Yeah. Well, I'm reminded, yeah. Some of you may have been here when Magali Rodriguez was part of this teaching staff. Wonderful woman from Cuba. She and her husband, Mossman, Jim Mossman, were working in the barrios in Miami. But Magali came up, like we all do, on the bus, and she said, what a cold, unfriendly place Holden is. She said, there's no music, there's no banners, There's no dancing.
And we're visual people.
And we're visual people, we, the Cubans.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And you know, that's an interface, uh-huh, which we are not sensitive to.
Oh, that's funny.
Mm-hmm. But we are now, there's banners and singing.
Well, there's some, but there, we don't have dancing in the streets. Yeah. Except, I guess, when the sun comes over the mountain in this area.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But the road's covered with snow.
But it's a cultural thing, uh-huh, and I think interfaces, mm-hmm, we need to pay attention to, mm-hmm, interfaces. Mm-hmm.
That's right. What does it, what may seem entirely welcoming to us, mm-hmm, to someone coming from another culture?
My cousin is pastor of a church in Queens. It has a high population of Caribbean folks, mm-hmm, and man, they sing.
Uh-huh. I think having support groups and educational type groups for people that have been divorced. And mm-hmm, so I noticed recently in a bulletin at our church that they're starting now a sort of a support healing group for women that have had abortions. Mm-hmm. And I think both just, you know, to get those kinds of words out in the open so people know it's okay to talk about those, sure, experiences, sure, in their life, and also I think, you know, all of us in churches have different views of those, but I think people that have experienced divorce and abortion have their stereotypes of what the church thinks about, mm-hmm, those. Mm-hmm. So it's nice to know that this is a place that talks about those things, mm-hmm, and will kind of help you on your,
sure,
journey.
Sure. That part of the dynamic of this kind of ministry is to pay attention to who it is who feels on the outside,
right,
for whatever reason.
Yes.
And sometimes we may not realize it, right? Now.
Interesting thought. sometimes we, boy, the Anglo-Saxon Protestants can feel on the outside. The church is changing. And we all think all have experienced that when you get into new ministries. The old folks say, what happened? You know, how come the pastor isn't standing up in the back of the lectern like he used to? He's now standing out in the aisle talking. Or in our church, we have a really very positive, enabling ministry, and the elders not only take communion around, they handle the complete service, including consecration of the elements and everything, when the pastor's gone on to something else. And that took some getting used to, some of the older folks. Uh-huh. And so in that sense, they're on the outside.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of a surprising turn of events, isn't it?
Yeah.
But that's one of the places where reconciliation is often needed in kind.